Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, June 14th. If you've been listening to the station over the last couple of days, you know that many people today are acknowledging the 50th anniversary of the publication of the Pentagon Papers, which lifted the veil on U.S. government secrets about the Vietnam War and helped lead to the resignation of Richard Nixon, right? There are multiple segments on the station yesterday and today about that history. But we've got a fresh one for you. Not a new set of Pentagon Papers. It's not about the military. Instead, it's an article called The Secret IRS Files. Trove of never-before-seen records reveal how the wealthiest avoid income taxes. Now, maybe you've heard a little about this already. Three ProPublica reporters analyzed over 15 years of tax returns from the richest Americans like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and many more. But in addition to just income and taxes, these records showed investments, audits, and debts. What did they find out? Well, the obtained records showed that American business moguls who have managed to exponentially grow their wealth throughout the years pay little and even in some cases, zero income taxes. Now, that may sound like something you already knew or at least suspected, but one interesting thing about the report is it alleges that the ultra-wealthy are able to avoid paying taxes most years legally and without even any need for offshore accounts or secret holdings. So what does this say about our tax code and the unequal treatment built into it, or should we all really just be taking notes so we can do this ourselves? Just kidding. And what does it say about the rest of us? Are we paying a high percentage of our income in taxes, a higher percentage than some of the world's richest people? And is that fair? Are we the 99.9% subsidizing the means for these ultra-wealthy Americans to live extravagant lives? Does our government need to do a serious reexamination of our tax code itself? Joining us now, Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter and editor at ProPublica. Hi, Jesse. Welcome back to WNYC. Thank you for doing this with us.
Hey, Brian. Happy to be back.
So, Jesse, you and your co-authors compare how much the ultra-wealthy pay in taxes, comparing that to their gain in wealth. So why do you use that measure instead of just simply looking at income and tax rates?
Right. It's a good question. So the conventional way to do this would be to measure taxes compared to income. And in fact, we do this in a companion piece. And we show that billionaires have a much lower effective tax rate in the conventional way than wealthy people or even someone, a single person making $45,000 a year. That itself is a blockbuster finding and very interesting. But we thought that it was much more interesting that, in fact, the data demonstrate that the ultra-wealthy are outside of the tax system almost entirely, that we have a system where people make money and they get salaries and the taxes get extracted from their salaries, and the wealthy don't. Their income is essentially optional. It's voluntary. They decide when to take it and how much to take, and then they reduce the taxes on that small amount of income. But they're really outside of the system, and so we thought that the better measure was taxes compared to their wealth growth.
Their income is optional, you said. They decide what to take of the money that they're actually taking or not for tax purposes. And the strategy that some of these ultra-wealthy folks use is framed in your piece as buy, borrow, and die. Can you break down each one of those?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. It's weird. It's hard to get your mind around it if you're a normal human being, as I say, who's in the tax system and has to work to live, as I do, as you do, as most listeners do. So buy, borrow, die is the way that some super wealthy approach their wealth and their how they live. And what it is that you buy or build or inherit your assets. So you're either Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, or you're somebody like, I don't know, Jamie Dimon, who hasn't built J.P. Morgan, but inherits the position and comes in, or you literally inherit like the Waltons or the Mars family, and you've got a great fortune. Then what you do, instead of selling your stock or selling your assets and getting money from that sale, you can borrow against the assets. And why would you borrow against the assets? Well, if you sell, you have to pay some capital gains tax. Or if you've got the equivalent amount in salary, you'd have to pay a top marginal rate of 37% today. Instead, you're borrowing at single-digit rates, so it's a much better deal for you. Plus, you get to hold on to your company this whole time, hold on to control, and you can keep rolling and rolling and rolling over the debt for a very long time. You defer any sale, and you increase the your wealth, and it compounds, especially if the company is growing like Amazon or Tesla. And then by the end of your life, there are a bunch of advantages that you can take to avoid or reduce estate taxes. Estate tax is the last kind of licks that the U.S. government has on you, and you're supposed to be taxed at 40%. But in fact, tax avoidance strategies for the estate tax after death and even right before death are myriad and available for the ultra wealthy. And so they're really not touched in substantial ways by the estate tax. And so you can get through having an enormous fortune that basically never is taxed.
According to the article, no one among the 25 wealthiest avoided as much tax as Warren Buffett, the grandfatherly centibillionaire. Now, that's a word many people have never heard before. What's a centibillionaire?
Yeah, it's a word that we haven't had much in society because we haven't had these kind of fortunes before. But that's somebody who's worth over $100 million. $100 billion with a B, dollars. I actually was someone corrected my grammar there that I should have said hecto-billionaire, that we use the Greek for 100 in that situation. But I like the sound of centibillionaire. But the point with Buffett is that no one takes as little income relative to his wealth and his wealth growth as Warren Buffett. And so he takes very, very little income and then is taxed relatively low rates on that very small income. It's enormous income for you and me, but it's relatively small for a person of his means and wealth. And so he has talked rather famously about having a low tax rate compared to the average person, compared to his secretary. In fact, when he talks about that, he's talking about his income tax rates, and the income tax rates, both capital gains rates and salary rates, you know, the top marginal rate, are basically irrelevant for him. He's talking about something that even if those rates were to go up, it would be essentially a rounding error for him. And so what we wanted to bring home is that discussion of tax rates in the current tax structure are almost irrelevant for the ultra, ultra wealthy.
Uh-huh. And in the case of Warren Buffett, when you mentioned him and his secretary, it probably reminds a lot of people that, wait, isn't Warren Buffett considered a progressive on these issues because he's out there with things like the Buffett rule and saying it's not fair that I would pay a lower income tax rate than my secretary?
Yes, it's a very complicated picture with Buffett. It's to his credit that he's raised these questions and complaints about our tax system. And one of the things that he points out is that taxes on capital, like when you sell a stock, you get a capital gain, and that's tax, and that has favorable tax status compared to salary. So those of us who don't have capital gains or are in the salary structure, we're paying higher rates than the people who sell. But what we wanted to point out, and my colleagues, Paul Keel and Jeff Ernsthausen, worked on this story with me, and are extraordinary reporters. And what we wanted to point out is somebody like Warren Buffett, you know, he talks about his rates on taxable income, and the taxable income that he has are minuscule compared to his overall wealth. So when you talk about his overall wealth, what he's really doing is he's paying, now compare this to an average person, typical person making $60,000 or $70,000, they're paying $14 of that to the government in federal income taxes. But when you talk about Warren Buffett, compared to his wealth growth, it's a different comparison, but it's effectively what his income is, his wealth growth. For the ultra wealthy, wealth growth is like income. He's paying 10 cents for every $100. So $14 to $100, and Buffett has 10 cents for $100.
I think we have a CPA calling in, so let's take his call first. David, you're on WNYC with Jesse Eisinger from ProPublica. Hi, David.
Hey, Jesse. Hey, everyone. I just wanted to provide one snippet of information. You know, the reporting is fantastic, but it is only one page of a book in terms of their overall life and tax strategy. So, you know, it worries me, the narrative of the conversation, just looking at 1 year when there's a lot more that may go on. And Jesse's also making fantastic points. I think touching the recognition of income and wealth is wrought with a lot of difficulty, but that capture on death and estate tax is really what needs to be addressed, because, you know, I don't believe, you know, billionaire may create wealth, but as children and offspring, do they really create wealth? And, you know, what are the rights around somebody inheriting without having, you know, moving dirt and doing work on that?
David, thank you. All right, let's take the estate tax piece of this. You want to give us a little deeper dive, Jesse?
Yeah, sure. I mean, he's absolutely right that the estate tax is a big part of it. What we wanted to show was that these great fortunes can compound and grow extraordinary amounts in life itself, and that current tax reform discussions of taxing the wealthy don't touch people in life. But the estate tax is avoided in a few ways. The basic structure is that, well, there are two things that are going on. One is that if you have capital gains, the moment you die, those are ignored for the purposes of taxes. So if you have a stock and you bought it at $10 and it goes up to $110, you've got $110 of gain. $100 of gain.
Untaxed.
And if you sold that today,
And oh, then I see. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, $100 a gain, and that gets taxed at $20. $20 gets taken out. Then if you die tomorrow and you give that to your children, they pay zero capital gains tax on that. They get it at $110, and the gain is wiped out, and taxpayers lose out on that tax. So that's one thing. That's called the step-up in basis. And then the second thing is that you have an estate tax, and the estate should be taxed on that, but there are lots and lots of ways to reduce that. Charitable giving, you wipe out your debt. So all that borrowing that we talked about before, borrowing to fund your lifestyle and borrowing to fund your business, that actually helps you in the estate tax because it takes away from the amount that's left over to get taxed. And then there are arcane sorts of complicated trusts that you can put money into to avoid gift and estate tax. Somebody like Sheldon Adelson, the late casino magnate, he put in billions and billions of dollars into these trusts. They're sort of like loopholes, but they're legal loopholes, aggressive, that are ways to avoid the estate tax. So it is evaded. The issue is that we don't really know how much is evaded from the or avoided from the estate tax because there's so little data on it. The IRS has very little data on it. Scholars have struggled to estimate it. And so that's really one of the black holes of the entire tax world.
The part of that that you just said that was new to me, and so it might be new to a lot of people, is even though we know this estate tax debate goes on in politics all the time, and, you know, the one side, mostly represented by Republicans, says, wait, I have this money, and I die, I can't just leave my money to my kids without the government taking a bite out of it. I already paid whatever taxes I legally owed, presumably, during the course of my lifetime. So why can't I just pass my money to my kids or whoever when I die? That's the one side of the argument. The other side of the argument is it's new income for the kids or whoever else the heirs are, then they should be taxed on it as new income. That's the usual debate. What you just revealed is that capital gains, which you're not taxed on until you take them out, take those gains out of the stock, for example, not taxed during your lifetime, then they never get taxed because they get passed on to your heirs under the estate tax laws without the tax being taken out. Did I understand you about that? Because that's really
that's
dramatic.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. And actually, the Biden administration has proposed closing this. It's called step up in basis or stepped up basis. And it's widely regarded as a flaw and an unintended consequence of the tax code. It's about 100 years old, and it was a law designed for a different solution and different regime, and not anticipated to be used this way. So there are a lot of critics of this, but it is a cherished giant loophole that is very, very valuable for a select few people. And so you can imagine that there's going to be an extraordinary fight if the Biden administration presses forward with trying to actually get it rescinded.
And even if the heirs, after having inherited those stocks, let's say, with capital gains, if they then take the capital gains to spend that money, they're not taxed on it because it passed tax-free in that respect?
So if they sold it right there, in my example, at $110, they wouldn't have any gain on it because it transferred to them at $110. But if it went up to $115, they would have to pay capital gains on the new $5 of gain. So, but what they do is it gets to be counted as if they bought it at the new level, the existing level, and everything else, all the past, all the history is wiped out.
Monty in Yorkville wants to elaborate on that question. Monty, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning to your guest. What I want to say that all the country has the same issue. No country I know, at least part of the OECD, that taxes unrealized profit. So there is absolutely no solution. The only thing that the U.S. government can do, which other do, all of them do, is tax long-term and short-term profit at the same rate. That means that give little incentive for someone to leave their profit going on and on and on forever, because one day they're going to have a really stiff bill, you know.
Monty, thank you very much. I think we're not ready to accept his conclusion that there is no solution. But how would you compare the U.S. to other countries in these respects, Jesse?
Well, it's funny. There is a country, a well-developed Western country, and most people in the country who have wealth are, and it's illiquid wealth, so can't really trade it very easily. And it's hard to assess from a day-to-day basis what it is, and it's taxed. And this is the form of wealth that most people in this country have, and it's taxed. The country that I'm talking about is called the United States, and what I'm talking about is property taxes. So, in fact, the vast majority of Americans have, if they have wealth at all, they have wealth in their homes, and their homes actually are taxed on an annual basis at the local level. And these are, as I say, illiquid assets and hard to value assets, but they're assessed. So the existence of wealth tax basically exists in this country. Now, the other thing I would say is that there are wealth taxes in other countries. Wealth taxes have not been particularly successful for a wide variety of reasons. France abandoned one relatively recently. Switzerland actually has a wealth tax, and it works pretty well. It's pretty modest, and they don't have capital gains taxes. There aren't tax regimes that focus on solely on unrealized gains. But, you know, the United States has a lot of influence, a lot of power, and it could do these things. It's not like taxing unrealized gains was prohibited by the Constitution. It was not sent down, written in stone from Mount Sinai. It's only about 100 years old, our tax regime, and there's nothing fixed about it.
If there were one or two policies that could start taxing income that goes under the radar legally, what might they be?
Well, you know, we're not policy advocates. We're just journalists. But there
are proposals.
Your
sources tell you.
Well, Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon, has a proposal to tax unrealized gains. And what that would be is a carefully designed policy there where you're essentially paying tax over the course of 10 years. And so if the gain disappears, one of the frequent arguments is this isn't real wealth. It fluctuates.
Right.
It
the stock
down.
Could go down tomorrow. Yeah.
Of course, the stock could go down tomorrow. And if it went down tomorrow, Jeff Bezos would still be worth, you know, $170 billion instead of $180 billion. So the wealth is a relatively permanent sort of fixture at that level, at that nosebleed level. But yes, you could design a unrealized gain tax where it unfolds over the course of 10 years. And if you still have the gain, you still owe the money. So that's one solution. And then the other solution is the IRS measures your wealth. This is what Warren and Sanders, the two senators who ran for president, proposed, where you have a wealth tax. And that's got some challenges, but it's easier these days because one of the things that we have today is a very effective and intensive banking system. And the banks estimate people's wealth all the time for the purposes of lending to them. So they're not just measuring publicly traded wealth like Bezos and Tesla's, Musk. Those guys have wealth that's relatively easy to measure because it's largely in publicly traded stock. Mm-hmm. But the Bloombergs of the world, the Kochs of the world, they have private empires, and those are harder to value. But there are lots and lots of banks, investment bankers and commercial bankers that understand the value of those assets very, very well. And you can actually value it pretty easily. It's not that complex. And if those third parties reported to the IRS, a wealth tax would be much harder to evade or avoid. And one of the regimes that we have, the reason why the vast majority of Americans pay their taxes is that it's extracted from a third party. It's extracted through the paychecks. And so there's well over 90% compliance for average people because we have no choice in the matter. Our taxes are already out before we see a dollar in take-home pay. But for the ultra-wealthy, they get taxed in a completely different way, often through complex partnerships and things like that. And so the compliance rates are really 50 cents on the dollar.
Well, wealth inequality in addition to income inequality, one of the defining issues of our age and helping us to understand a piece of it. Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter and editor at ProPublica, with two of his colleagues. He wrote the article, "The Secret IRS Files, Trove of Never-Before-Seen Records Reveal How the Wealthiest Avoid Income Taxes." Jesse, thanks so much, and I look forward to the rest of the project.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.